Welcome to the Founderholic Podcast. My name is Chris Falaya. I'm your host, and thank you for joining. We're going to be talking about how to build the best talent in your startup. You know, you ask yourself the question, when do I hire X, Y, or Z? At what price? What time? You know, you start thinking about how do I know they'll fit into the culture and the structure that I'm trying to develop and create. How do I interview them? Do I do Zoom? Do I do it in person? What am I looking for when interviewing? What are the questions to ask when interviewing? What about scaling my business and hiring for scale? What do I need to do there? Guess what? We have Sarah Fitzmaurice from Executives in Africa, and all she does and all her firm does is hire executives for startups and major corporations. So there's no better person to answer those questions. I'm not talking to a CEO or a founder that hired a bunch of good people. I'm talking to Sarah, who has hired tons of executives for over 2 decades. So we're going to get experience overload. In fact, I'm going to just ask a few questions and let Sarah take it from there, because she is a wealth of information. And when a wealth of information is giving you information, you just sit back, listen, take notes, so you can become a better founder. And that's what I want you guys to do. So enjoy this episode. Many questions will be answered, and you will learn how to hire right, build that structure, and ensure that you're building that culture and hiring the right people within your company to ensure it grows into something you want it to grow into, which is something magnificent. So let's get this episode started, and I will let Sarah Fitzmaurice of Executives in Africa really pretty much just take it from here. Hi, Sarah. Thank you for joining the Founderholic Podcast. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thanks for joining. I appreciate your time. I know you are a very busy person. So thank you.
Pleasure. I think everyone is, cool. Aren't we?
Yeah. Well, you started a company that I think is very interesting. It's called Executives in Africa, and you help companies, really good companies in Africa, build leadership teams like no other. How did that start?
Thank you, Chris. So just to be absolutely clear, I joint founded it with Richard Putley, who's my business partner, and 14 years ago now, in March 2010. Wow. And I'd been working with Richard for quite a long time, and we had, I've got about probably 25, 30 years experience now in recruitment, expanded into executive search, covering emerging markets, particularly Russia, CIS, and then we started working in Africa. And in my mid-20s, I actually traveled down through Africa. I flew into Nairobi and traveled overland in the back of a truck, literally down through various countries through to South Africa. So always had a love and a fascination for it. And I think there's something that if you're not officially African, but you land in Africa and you feel that affinity. So there's a lot of people that say I'm African at heart in many ways, because I feel that affinity with the continent. And the opportunity came up. Richard and I have been sort of working and starting to build a division in Africa, and it was at the time there was some issues in the global markets, and the company that we were working from had some financial struggles, and Rich and I said, well, you know, let's carry on what we're doing, but do it on our own. And we came up with the name imaginatively. We said, let's just call the company Executives in Africa. It does what it says on the tin. We place executives in Africa. We also do sort of senior leaders, managers and things like that. And yeah, we set the company up. Initially, it was just Richard and myself. And we're going back to 2010. So actually, at the time, there was very few professional recruitment companies covering Africa, and even fewer search firms. And actually, one of the first pieces of business, we actually were working with a very well known FMCG company in Nigeria, and they'd been a bit stuck looking for a CFO for their business in Nigeria, and gone to a search firm, said, you know, can you help us find a CFO in Nigeria? This is one of the global search firms, and that the company said, yes, we can. But because it's in Nigeria, our standard fees are 33%, but because it's Nigeria, that's more difficult. So it'd be 43%. And they actually put their prices up because it was going to be more difficult. And we said, well, look, you know, this is what we do. It's all we do. We're focused on Africa. And we delivered them a short list of, it's actually finance directors, divisional finance directors, Nigerian nationals. And previously they'd had a lot of expats. And we said, look, no, there's good quality African talent here. So we found them Nigerian nationals and a short list of Nigerian nationals. And then they said, this is fantastic. You know, we've not usually had such quality candidates that are Africans and locally. And this is great for us because it, you know, it means that we can support localization strategies and it's better for costs because, you know, it's not costing us employee expats. Can you help us with a marketing director? So we went out and we helped them with a marketing director. And then they said, we've been struggling with this packaging director, this packaging, you know, group packaging director role for, you know, the last 2 years. I don't suppose you're having a, you fancy having a crack at that. So, you know, we said, yeah, well, you know, absolutely. So, and it just really went from there. And we invested, you know, we invest time in every single search right from the start. It's, you know, both Richard and I have always been very committed about doing a really good quality job.
Thank you so much for that, Sarah. It speaks to the fact that you figured a way to distinguish yourself in the market by providing these intricate, you know, hires that businesses have been unable to, you know, to fill, and roles businesses have been unable to fill. You added your unique twist and plus all that goes into finding the best candidate. And you guys have figured it out. You've come up with your own formula, your own process, which we'll be jumping into shortly. But it's good to hear another founder like yourself and co-founder talk about the passion that they have and how it all started. My next question, which is about understanding a team and how you build that, because someone in your capacity and doing what your organization does, you get to see an array of different individuals from all walks of life trying to apply for a certain job. And you guys help companies even from the get-go build that, you know, executive suite profile. It's even in your name. So how do you understand the right team and the behavior profile, and how do you recognize that everyone is not perfect to be an entrepreneur? Mm. What are those key things that you're looking for in an individual when you're interviewing them or looking at their CVs or their resumes that really sticks out? Is it, what process do you have? Because I'm sure most of the listeners are very interested as they're building teams for their companies, trying to understand what to look for in those in that behavior profiles.
I think there's two key things to that. I think number one, when we're working with a client, when we're working with a particular organization, it's not that job descriptions get thrown out the window, but they do a little bit. Because the way we approach, and what's one of the things that really sets us apart when we're working with companies, is to understand what is the company trying to achieve and the role that they're looking to recruit for, how does that role contribute to achieving that part of the strategy? So, and that's a slightly, that's a, so it, it means that we're taking a business approach to bringing talent into a team rather than saying, we need to hire a CFO. And, you know, and because there's various different things that a CFO can do depending on what stage a company's at. So what do we actually need that CFO to achieve in the next, you know, in the next 12 months, in the next 3 years? Well, actually, one of the key things is we've got, you know, we are looking to scale, for example, which is a lot of, you know, if companies are setting up, they look to set up and scale. So we're looking to scale the company. So we want somebody to come in that's actually seen what big looks like and knows where we are now, and therefore can map that out and knows that if we implement the systems and processes and controls that we've got at this stage, then by the time we get there, they're not going to break. Because what you don't want to do is you know, have a CFO that builds something that and then it, you grow and it starts creaking, and then it has to, you know, you have to be continually evolving it. It's much better if you can actually set it up right in the first instance. You know, so there might be a piece around sort of systems, processes, and controls, which is a technical requirement. And then equally, there may well be that, you know, that we that organization is saying, right, actually, and the other key thing is we need this person to provide us business insights. So we want somebody that's going to be not only technically good at capturing the information and making sure there's, you know, there's the right controls and governance environment, but we want to then provide business insights and actually be adding value to the leadership team and saying, why are we doing it like this? Have you thought about that? Look, I've been playing around with these numbers. I think there's an opportunity to do this, getting pricing right, whatever it might be. So that whole feedback piece that then looks off. So then you think, okay, that's going to be another core area that we're going to look at. So we've then got sort of two key things to look at. And then maybe the third piece would be, and it's sort of potentially linked to the systems and processes, is we're going to then take through various sort of fundraising. So, you know, and what you don't want to do is get to the fundraising and find out that you haven't got the systems and governance in place that, you know, any potential investor is going to look at you and go, you know, your controls are not robust enough, you know, and so get that piece right. So, you know, it's looking through that whole 3-year journey and saying, you know, we would ideally like somebody that actually has taken a company through some sort of, you know, Series A, Series B fundraising, you know, and that's a completely different skill set to somebody like a financial director, for example, that is, you know, that is holding the skill set that actually creates the strategy for going to market and identifying investors and going on that roadshow is a completely different skill set. So now what we've done there is we've taken the business strategy and we've formulated three key areas for that finance, that particular finance role that could differ completely from that very first finance role that we did in FMCG, for example, which was an established business that wasn't in this high growth, hyper growth startup mode, that wasn't planning to raise money in 3 years' time. So it's about creating the understanding those areas. And then the second thing is to then look at those areas and say, what's going to be difficult about that? What is going to be difficult about achieving that in practice? What do we envisage is going to be difficult? You know, and things like systems and processes and controls, actually getting people working differently, that's a really big challenge. So then that then looks at how do we find a leader that has got a track record in actually really embedding processes. There's one thing about I was talking about this. It's one thing about implementing processes, but actually getting people to do what you want them to do, this new way of working, it's really good. Yeah, that's great. But we like doing it this way. And I know how to do it this way. And I've been doing it like this way for the last 2 years. So, you know, it's comfortable. People don't like change. So any sort of change management, that whole piece is that's quite difficult to interview against. And how and actually, it's not what people have done. It's how they've made something stick that is the important. And, you know, the business analysis, you know, that's great. But, you know, give some examples, give some evidence of where you have, you know, identified an opportunity. And how did you present that? And how was it received by your founder? Was it immediately adopted? In which case, that was really, really easy. That's great. But what happens if, you know, the founder pushed back and said, no, I don't think that's right, but you really believed in that? How did you get somebody to listen to you? And it's all these hows that are really, really important to try and understand. So I think one of the things in terms of interviewing that I would say as a takeaway is, you know, identify sort of three core areas that are going to have, it's the old sort of 80-20 rule. It might make up 20% of the job, but it's going to give 80% of the results. And then really spend time really digging down deeply rather than trying to cover every single bullet point on your job description and do a tick list, but not going into any depth. So that would be the sort of the first thing that I would say is it's about, you know, really focusing what are the behaviors that are going to get the 80% of results and make a difference in impacting the business strategy that you want to achieve. Where does this role, what does good look like? What does good look like in 12 months' time? What do you see and hear this person doing if you think they've done a good job? And it's about, I'm a very visual person, it's about understanding and trying to look forward and say, what does that actually look like? So we spend a lot of time really reflecting on that, what that good looks like. And then the second piece, and I will keep this a bit shorter, which is really, really critical in hiring, especially in startup companies, is getting leaders that are aligned to your purpose. Why do you exist as an organization? I think a lot of founders are, you know, and entrepreneurs and new businesses are really looking to solve a problem, in particular in Africa. It's actually, you know, there's, you know, greater accessibility to financial services, you know, supporting farmers to be able to actually have access to you know, better knowledge and tools that enable them to be more successful and therefore lift them out of sort of poverty to a position and give them the support. There's all these sorts of organizations. So, you know, what's your why as an organization? Why do you exist? And I'm a great believer, if you hire leaders, in particular leadership team, that's really aligned with why you exist as an organization, that's a massive driver. It's a massive driver in terms of the amount of work people put in. People don't put in long hours and hard work because, you know, because they love working really, really long hours. They put it in because they believe in what they're doing, and it, you know, it matters to them to actually make a difference. So getting that alignment is really, really important. And interestingly, it can be a really, really good attraction tool, because moving jobs is I always say moving jobs is horrible. Nobody wants to change jobs. You're in your comfort. You're doing your role. You're going along quite nicely. If you have to move jobs and go into a new organization, you've got new people to learn, new systems to learn. You know, there's a lot of new things there, and not everybody likes that. And that might be quite surprising to founders, because founders tend to be quite entrepreneurial and self-driven and things like that. And it's like, yeah, but I love change. I love change and growth and all this chaos and uncertainty. I love that. Yes, you do, but not everybody does. And I think if you can recognize that, then you recognize the fact that actually moving jobs, and in particular, maybe going from a larger organization to a small organization where the future is a bit more risky, that's not going to be aligned to everybody's way of thinking. Not everyone's going to be comfortable for that. And one of the strongest, I'm a great fan of Simon Sinek, and one of the strongest motivators for talent attraction and getting people on board is to, as he says, start with why. So start with why. This is why we exist as an organization. And then people suddenly are feeling you from the heart. This is why we exist as an organization, you know, and they're like, you know, great, fantastic. Now, what do you want me to do? Great. You know, and it's all, you know, it's the classic, you had me at hello. So I think that, you know, if people are building teams and creating it, it's about getting that sort of what is the 20% that's going to deliver 80% of the success. Focus in on it, visualize it. What does it look like? What does good look like? What is going to be difficult about that? And spend time interviewing against, you know, three core areas rather than 15, trying to cover everything. And really connect with your talent really, really early by connecting with your why. Why do you exist as an organization? Does that matter to them? And that's how you will tempt people out of other jobs to join a more risky, you know, less stable type organization. Because and recognizing the fact that not everybody thinks like founders do.
Oh, thank you. So I want to ask a few questions about a few things you said, because it's interesting. In building a proper team and a good team, beyond the asking or the whole why question and making sure the person you plan on hiring is aligned, have you found that, one, people moving from a large company to a smaller company in general is a good thing? Because I know it bothers me and it bothers a lot of people, because they say, oh, you know, you're moving from a huge, massive company. You know, you had so many people who were working for you, doing this task, that task, this task. You were just this guy up on the top, you know, checking boxes, saying, yeah. But you actually, your experience level in going deep into the, you know, the Excel file, for example, if you're in finance, or doing deep marketing, if you're in marketing and you're just not the marketing executive and you had somebody working on social media, somebody working on print and all that stuff. Have you found that transition in most cases from a large corporation to a startup in most cases a good thing or a bad thing for that entrepreneur hiring? So the question is really from the entrepreneur standpoint. Mm-hmm. Is it okay for me to look at executives from big multi-billion dollar corporations, or is that probably not the way to go? And I know this is not one size fits all.
Yeah.
But just in general, what have you seen in general?
And I think, you know, I think that is that is the million-dollar question, and there's definitely not a one-size-fits-all. The key thing that if somebody's worked, there's a couple of sort of, there's the benefits and then the downsides. One of the benefits of somebody that's worked within a large organization is they've seen what good looks like, and I talk in very sort of basic streak. So they've seen best practice processes. This is, you know, this is ideally, you know, what good looks like. So there's that can be a really, really good thing. On a downside, you need to understand how somebody's going to cope if you take away all their resources and their standard performers and, you know, this, that and the other. And because and that is the key when you're interviewing is you need to try and work out how, I think probably one of the best words I sort of like, or one of the things that best things I like to hire for is resourcefulness. Because when you, one of the things that when you're working with a large organization, 10 people don't tend to need to be so resourceful, because as you say, they can call on this person, they call on that, they can, you know, tap into group systems that give them a training course on this and tell them how to do that and whatever it might be. And so there's that, not that need to be resourceful. And actually, interestingly, the FMCG company that I was talking about earlier, one of the reasons that they'd struggled with this packaging role for so many years when we first joined them was because they were a fairly independent organization in Nigeria, and they were headhunting from big multinationals, the likes of Unilever and Reckitt Benckiser and all these sorts of people, where, you know, all these similar people that were doing similar products and packaging and looking at the packaging managers. And I'll be honest, you know, because I'm very open and honest, the first shortlist that we did was like, you know, this is great. We've got a packaging manager from Unilever, we've got a packaging manager from Procter & Gamble. This is a good shortlist. All Nigerians. I'm like going, yes, winning here. And we went through and they all got rejected, did an interview, you know, and that was like, okay, right. So what bit have we missed here? Because there's something in this whole, in the whole briefing through to looking at what have we missed here? I remember really clearly, and I spoke to the HR chap and I said, I need to speak to the supply chain director directly, and I need to work out what's missing. And the piece that was missing was resourcefulness, because these candidates have been so used to working in a country where they had access to all these resources for doing their job. And he was saying that is just not going to work here in Nigeria, because, you know, you order something, you order a cap at a certain micro thickness or whatever it might be, and it turns up and it's not quite, and you stick it onto your packaging line and the machines start turning them and all the caps start cracking, and, you know, suddenly you've got to bin several thousands of cracks. So that you need to be a bit more resourceful in terms of not just take things at face value, but follow up, and, you know, and when the packaging supplier says we do it like this, we can't get around that, then you need to work with them and be resourceful and say, how do we work around that, because these resources are just not available for the products that we've got in Nigeria, and you need to be more creative. So I think it comes down to its resourcefulness and the attitude to really roll your sleeves up and actually get stuck in. Is this somebody that's actually, you know, had a problem and rolled their sleeves up? And I remember one leader telling me a great story about, you know, how they had a manufacturing line and it broke down, and they, you know, and it was, you know, everyone knows your manufacturing line breaks down and that's a significant impact on the bottom line. You know, he went down there, down to the shop floor, they were missing a shop part and a spare part, and he worked with the engineers to craft this piece out of metal and almost literally carve it or whatever you do to metal to create this spare part and problem solve. So I think it's that resourcefulness, it's that problem solving. And as long as you've got that alongside the best practice, knowing what good looks like, which is a great thing to be bringing, if you can combine the two, that's your ideal combination. So I think, yes, go for the people that have worked in the big organizations, but you've got to assess them. Do they have that resourcefulness? Do they have that problem solving skills? And I'm a great fan of failure questions. So, you know, everyone's really good at telling you everything that's gone right, but actually where you find out how good somebody is by asking them, you know, where did it go wrong and how did you deal with that? And how did you solve that problem? And those are the best, those are the best interview questions ever. So yeah, if you don't take anything else away, ask people failure questions, ask them where it all went wrong. Don't just ask them where all the good things they've done, because we're all good at talking about that.
Talking about the good stuff. Wow, yeah. Fantastic. And in today's society with people, you know, everybody's virtual, people working from home and all of that, do you promote or do you think it's required when interviewing someone or before you hire someone to have a face-to-face? Or have you found that, you know, just doing everything over a Zoom call or virtually pretty much works before that last hire?
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting question. I think where possible, meet face-to-face. You know, I mean, Zoom is fantastic. Mm. And or whatever media you're using, it is fantastic. It's very it's a very efficient way of interviewing, because you obviously not got the travel time, and you know, it makes people a lot more accessible, especially you know, if you're a very busy leader, to find time to actually get out of the office, go to an interview, do the interview and come back is probably, you know, 3 hours out of the office, and you've got to make an excuse for that. Shutting your office door and doing an interview makes it a little bit more accessible. So I think that sort of interviewing is a really good way early stages. But I think, you know, especially with, you know, we're talking about founders here. This is, you know, this is your baby, you know, and in order to get that real alignment, you know, there is that chemistry that has got to be there, in my opinion. And I think, you know, it's not always essential, especially with key people that are going to make a decision, you know, make an impact on how your business performs in the next 3 to 5 years. You know, we all want to hire people yesterday. You know, there's all that, you know, people only ever come to us when they sort of like, you know, when do you need somebody? yesterday. Everybody always wants to hire yesterday. Everyone thinks always plans too late for hiring. But, you know, actually, you know, the old adage, a stitch in time saves you nine. You know, the cost of getting a hire wrong is so phenomenal. You know, there's so many hidden costs of, you know, of lost time, lost market share, you know, especially if you're in a competitive market and you're vying for space, and, you know, which a lot of these new businesses are. The cost of getting it wrong is, you know, is huge. And so I would just say, just don't rush it. And wherever possible, you know, always meet face to face and check what motivates that person. What, you know, what makes them tick? Because, you know, the technical stuff, you can tick the boxes in terms of technical, but can this person do the job is literally only part of it. Their attitude and their approach to how they do the job and how motivated they are and how much they take real ownership of the success of the organization, that's a much more emotional thing. And I think, you know, in particular early key hires, or where you're really relying on somebody for scaling or a really critical hire, I would say, you know, meet people face to face.
Speaking about scaling and growing a business, what are the systems that you've seen that really work? Because as a company grows, we have to scale. You're talking about, you know, not hiring and not being frantic in hiring, trying to get somebody yesterday. What are the things that you have seen that work that you can put in place to help a business, you know, scale at a good rate? And what kinds of systems do you recommend that they put in place so they're not reinventing the wheel to ensure consistency with quality as they grow?
Look, I think it obviously depends on the type of organization you are. And speaking from, you know, my own experience, so we are obviously a services business that's, you know, effectively consulting. So our offering is sort of through people. So it's about thinking about your own organization and how do you ensure, especially when you're looking from founder and growing outwards. So I think this is something that Richard and I really looked at when we were setting up the systems and processes. We were saying, like, we're really good and experienced at what we do, and we know what we're doing. As we bring people into the organizations, chances are that they are going to be less experienced than us. So we need to ensure that there's a consistent quality of service that goes out to the market. And we always said it shouldn't matter whether it's, you know, myself or one of my consultants, or, you know, that is actually delivering the search. The quality that the company receives at the end of the process should be the same, no matter whose hands have touched that search effectively. So it was about, I think there's a couple of things. So in terms of breaking it down, there's the actual process flow and actually mapping out. So we're actually, you know, I am quite anal when it comes to process and systems. I'm like fanatical about, you know, this is how we do things around here. And we literally flow charted it. And we literally went from, this is step A, this is, you know, from the point of actually signing a contract out, going through the stakeholder briefing, these are the questions that are covered, this is the information that we need. That then gets translated into an internal document to capture that, so that you know, because different people hear different things. So we're looking at trying to get consistency across and making, I guess, eliminating human error. So we looked at the whole, sort of went through our process step by step by step, and where can we eliminate human error or human interpretation at each step, so that we get as much consistency in terms of the service that we're offering. It's different when you're working with a product, because a product is, you know, it's got a you know, you make the product and out it goes. When you're looking at delivering a service, there's a lot more room for variety in that. So we wanted to get that consistency. So it's about mapping out the process very early on and saying, this is what is expected, and you go through these processes, which is then trained as people come on board. Very simple things like having proformas, use of proformas. So don't reinvent the wheel. There's no point, you know, if we've got a variety of standard sort of early stage, here's some initial information slides, here's a proposal if somebody actually wants to go ahead, here's a contract. So rather than people writing them from scratch, you know, there's a certain amount of information that is standard, and then there's a certain amount of information that you fill in. So, you know, use a pro forma document. So we have a job setup file. So, you know, for every job, you basically say, right, here's every single pro forma that you might need in that particular instance, and you dump it under client X, and then you've got access to all those resources. So it comes back to a bit like, and interestingly, I think it's funny, maybe it comes from the fact that I used to work for a very large international finance recruitment company that had very, very good systems and processes. So we sort of applied that to our small company. So, you know, having proformas, if you're a service company, just say, let's make sure we're protecting the brand by the quality of the content that's going out, and controlling that without wanting to sound too much like a control freak. But it's important, because you want to know that whatever information is being sent out, you know, by anybody across the organization is the consistent quality that you would want. I think the main things were mapping that process through, identifying the areas where potentially there was room for interpretation, for people to do things at a different quality that Richard or I would do as standard, and making sure that the support was in there to either to, you know, to provide the standard ways of doing things, training, and, you know, and then check. So we've got a whole sort of, you know, a whole quality assurance system in terms of, you know, there's literally, you know, what goes in bold on the CV, what goes in capitals, what goes in full stops and things like that. So the standardization, because if you spend money on an executive search, you know, the thing that you get to see is the CV at the end of it. So, you know, if we present you a CV that's got spelling mistakes on, or is poorly formatted and things like that, the impression that you get of the work, all the work, the hundreds of hours, literally, you know, it can be about over 100 hours for a particular search that's gone on behind the scene for that particular search. If you see that the end product is a CV and it's got typos on it, and it's not very well formatted, and it's not standard, and one CV looks different to the next CV and things like that, your impression is slightly slapdash, and so you think there's slapdash behind, you know, there's slapdash behind it. And because we are so diligent behind, it was really, really important that what was then going out to our the marketplace was diligent as well. So I think mapping the process, pro formas, and then I think the other thing that is really, really critical that I see in a lot of organizations sort of going through this stage is the use of a CRM, and you know, where possible, because that's about effective knowledge capturing. And as you grow an organization, I think it's really, really important, especially as a founder, to say, how are we capturing information? How are we capturing it? How are we sharing it across the organization? And is it accessible to everybody so everybody can benefit from it? Because what you don't want is information kept up here, because you know, if that person walks out the door, that information walks out with it, you know, and that can have a huge impact on the company. So it's always looking about where are the risks, where are the exposures, and, you know, are we capturing all the knowledge and in such a way that it can be accessible to everyone? I know in the early stages, my consultants used to naturally, they people love using Excel spreadsheets and going, oh, I'm just capturing all this information on an Excel spreadsheet, and it almost used to be like a swear word. It's like, don't use an Excel spreadsheet, you can capture it all on the CRM, and if it's on the CRM, then everybody's got visibility of it. So, you know, it's about looking at, you know, ways of working and how are people working to make sure that people aren't doing things, you know, in silos, but actually there's standard ways of working. It's interesting bringing people into that are sort of, you know, it was, you know, we used to, I remember, you know, people coming in and we go through the induction process and the training, and we say, you know, we call it the process, the search process. We've got a really documented way of running the search process. And initially you can see people saying, this is really like detailed and really controlled. And we're like, and we were like, go with it. And as you learn it, you can see consultants actually almost relaxing, because they understand that, you know, how actually then the process supports them, because at any one point they could go back and, you know, we made it very accessible. So the ways that we recorded things on the CRM were standardized in terms of, you know, just literally the way we log the information. There was a standard way of doing things, but and it's as I said, it sounds really, really controlling, but then if I'm suddenly struck down ill and I'm off for 2 weeks, what it means is somebody can literally parachute into my job. They can see exactly where I'm at. All the documentation is named in a standardized way in all the folders and the files. It's really, people know where to find documentation because it's done in a certain way. People can see more or less where it's got up to and can pick things up. So it's very easy for people to drop in and out. And I think that transferability of systems is really, really important. So I think that ability to sit back and think about, how is this going to work when it's bigger, and this is what Richard and I did, and actually funny enough, one of the reasons we set this up was because Richard and I were based probably about 60 miles apart at the time, and when we first set up the business, we ended up telling each other everything that we'd done. We spent most of the time telling each other what we'd done. It's like, we're wasting so much time just explaining what has been done and what hasn't been done, so let's design a system that basically says that you can look at this folder, and according to what's in it and what's not in it, you'll know what's been done. Whatever your business is, trying to envisage a way of working. And I think probably people are a bit more open to it now because of remote working. It has to be set up a little bit more like that. But we set it up like that from the start, and then added somebody in and said, let's see, you know, as we scale, as we add people in, as we add in consultants, are we still going to get the consistency of quality going out? You know, are the same things going to be followed? And I remember we both Richard and I, we sort of like, we're almost holding our breath as we sort of got to about 10 consultants. It's like, is it still holding up? It's like, yeah, everybody is following the process and the quality is still really, really high. So actually, you know, having that ability to, you know, you will know certain people that can sort of forward think and plan and say, okay, this is great, this works with one or two people, but when we get it up to 10 people, when we get it up to 20, when we get it up to 50, how is that going to work at scale? And, you know, is everybody going to know what's expected of them, so we don't lose quality, so we don't lose, you know, so we're consistently delivering at that same level. So I think it's mapping processes, standardization of naming documents, CRM if you know appropriate, so you're capturing stuff in the same place so people have got access to it. Right. And in some ways we were really, really lucky because we'd set up this business and we had people working over sort of 2, 3, 4 different locations. And you know, when COVID hit and everyone, you know, was like, literally you have to go and work from home, we just our consultants literally picked up their laptops, went home, plugged them in, carried on working, and we didn't have to change anything because people were so used to work, it was more or less seamless. And we were particularly right. smug at that time, I think.
In building this scaling scenario and having these processes in place, I know some people have, you know, they want to scale quick, they just got funding, and based on the funding, they need to scale rapidly. Do you believe in the hire fast, fire fast model? Have you seen it work? Because some people say, look, let's just get people in. If they can't cut it within 2 months, 3 months, just get them out, replace them till we find the right person. I know that is a scaling technique that some people have used. And I'm just curious if you've seen it, if you think it's efficient yourself. I've never used that technique myself, but I do know people who have. I'm curious what you think about that.
It may well be because of where we're working. So we work at sort of senior management leadership level. And because of where we work, you know, these tend to be fairly critical hires, and you can't afford to get it wrong. Even for when you're going fast, you just can't afford to get 3 months down the line and realize that somebody isn't working out and having to go through that whole process again. You know, so it may well just be that it doesn't work at the level that we work, or I certainly don't agree with it. I think there are some dangers with hiring fast and firing fast. Is you need to have very, very clear criteria for why somebody doesn't work out, because the danger is the easy thing is to let somebody keep working and you end up with mediocrity. That can be very, very costly, because if I said to you, look, you can hire somebody who's going to give you growth like that, or you can hire somebody who's going to give you growth like that, how much would you pay me to tell you which is candidate A and which is candidate B? You know, so it's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
And that's not right. about, you know, it's not just about how much would you pay me to tell you that information, but actually how much time would you spend to invest to make sure that you'd hired that person and not that person? And at what point right. and where are you checking it to say what growth trajectory are they on, or what results trajectory are they on? And, you know, at what point do we pull the plug? So I think, and then the knock-on concern about that whole hire fast, fire fast is it's really bad reputationally. If you mm-hmm. want to hire the best talent into the organization, you need to be going to market with the right messaging. And that whole EVP, so the employee value proposition, part of that, you know, we all know companies that, you know, in the marketplace where, you know, oh, don't go there. If you don't work out, they, you know, they fire you really quickly. And it's, you know, and that's okay for the people that don't work out, but I don't think it reflects particularly brilliantly on the organization, because it means you're not investing enough time in hiring in the first place into your people. Therefore, how important are your people to you? And, you know, why are they not working out? What, you know, is it you? Is it the organization? Are you a horrible, you know, you're a horrible leader to work for? You just really, you're not the sort of person that actually people get in. They love the company, but, you know, can't work with you at all because, you know, of X, Y, and Z. There are a variety of people, but what you don't want is question marks in the marketplace in right. terms of how you're perceived as a potential employer, especially at that high growth stage. You want to invest in getting it right. So I would actually say, you know, and if it's the low level, high volume that you need, invest in a really, really, really good HR person. So before you go out hiring, invest in a really, really good HR person that is actually going to be rewarded on getting the right people in that then hit their really, you know, hit certain targets and things like that. And actually spending an extra $20,000 on a really strong HR person, you know, when you're hiring lots of people, it's a no-brainer when you think of it like that. But very few people do it. Very few people, and actually it comes around to another area we've not talked about, very few founders and, you know, when people are growing companies, very few people invest early enough in a really good quality HR person. And if you can get a really good quality HR person, we're talking that that impacts on culture. It, you know, if you get a good HR person that's a very, very good, you know, an HR BP, you know, this is somebody that is commercially supporting your the growth of your leaders. What do you need in terms of talent? I mean, how many? I think we, you know, we were at the Africa Tech Summit last year, weren't we? In London. And it was, you know, across the board, you know, what keeps you up at night? And people were saying, talent, access to good talent, you know, and yet founders invest so little time and money in getting that right. And whether that's through externally committing to like a search firm like ours to go out and search and get a key leadership position, or hiring a really good HR person that's going to work alongside you to say, what is your strategy? What are going to be the people impact? You know, everyone knows that, you know, your greatest asset is your people within an organization. And yet everybody looks at, you know, access to financing. What's, you know, we've got to raise money. We're going to raise this money. Now we've got to scale and things like that. But yeah, but, invest in a really decent HR person that's going to help you with that people strategy, that's going to look at actually bringing people into the organization, giving them a great first impression, giving them a really clear induction, giving them a very clear training program so that actually, you know, they get up and running really, really quickly. So they've got access to all the resources they need. They're not wasting time and weeks on end because they haven't got a screen that they need. You know, it's, yeah. You know, that, you know, these are really silly things. But, you know, when you talk about them, you go, oh, yeah, it's so obvious. But actually, the founders that you work with, Chris, how many of them don't invest enough time in getting their talent, making sure they're getting the right talent on board, and making sure that talent is supported and nurtured and given the tools and the training to be effective as quickly as possible?
Yeah.
And creating the culture of sharing and collaboration and knowledge sharing and so many things. It's overlooked.
No, I agree.
So often.
I agree. It's a problem. It's not something founders. Yeah. And it's not something we think about in the beginning, because one is we're very cautious about the funds, and we're thinking about each hire needs to be putting money into the bottom line,
yeah,
like right away. So we need the marketing person to just be bringing money in. And then, you know, yeah, I need the finance person to make sure the money that's coming in is spent the right way, and so on and so forth, that you end up pushing out this HR person and the, you know, and you think you can do it all by yourself, because it's ingrained in our DNA as entrepreneurs. Oh, we can do it. We can find somebody. I know what I'm looking for. We can find somebody. But till you work with a company like you, like yours, you don't realize how much you're lacking and how intricate and detailed you have to be in finding that right person. So, I mean, just full disclosure to the people listening, I used executives in Africa to find my CFO for one of my companies, and best CFO ever. But okay. I probably would have, yeah, thank you. But I probably would have thought, I'll just, you know, find a CFO from a good company and he or she would be fantastic. But no, as you've mentioned, there are questions. You have to go for the why. You have to think about culture, and list goes on and on and on. And we do not think about that. That's just the honest truth. We're just thinking about
you hire somebody
our
you
idea.
Know. That's the what people do. Exactly. Yeah, I'm gonna hire. I know somebody who's done accounting. I'll bring them in. But that is the big danger. Is, you know, yes, you can bring that in and it solves the short term problem. Is that the best person? Because that's probably that person. And how much is it worth to you if you can come to me and say, I can get you that person? And, and equally, your HR person, you know, as well. They can add so much. A good HR business partner, commercially minded, is worth their weight in gold to the value that they will bring to your organization. In terms of actually, you say you want them effective quickly, but what, you know, you're bringing them in and you're expecting them to be effective quickly. But what support are you giving them as a founder to make sure that they have got all the resources, the training, you know, literally navigating a new CRM and, you know, and training and things like that. You know, if you can identify different roles, you pick five critical roles that can make an impact. Salespeople, for example, let's take a, you know, sales-led business. If you could identify, you know, the barriers to a salesperson being successful quickly within your organization, and make sure they're that every, you know, your human resources person is targeted and has a, you know, a key objective to say, I want to make sure that every new salesperson in this organization has got all these barriers overcome within the first, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. I would imagine it would probably have an impact on how quickly your salespeople start making money and bringing in business. So it's investment well done. But I think sometimes it's, you know, we expect them to come in and, you know, just get going. And there's not enough investment in understanding the people drivers and the behavioral drivers that actually make somebody successful in a role. And if you can identify those, it has a massive impact on bottom line. Massive impact on that bottom line.
Right. Very interesting. Very interesting.
Everyone's good at being busy, but we need people to be effective. And especially as founders, you know, we can't afford to not be effective. Interestingly, do you know, it's really funny actually, because when we and I say this from experience, because Richard and I implemented a business model internally that sort of probably about 5 years into our journey, and it seemed to logically it sort of made sense that, you know, we had a specific team focused on delivery, and we had certain consultants that were focused on business development, account management, things like that, and then this dedicated delivery team. And what we found, and this, because this, we tasked this delivery team, the objective we'd given them was to, your job is to ensure that the shortlist is of the best quality. So what happened, the behaviors that we saw as a result of that was our delivery team basically ended up over interviewing. So they were ending up, what was important to them to be seen to be doing daily was, you know, they'd be going around going, I've done five back-to-back interviews a day today. I've done 20 interviews this week. And it was almost like the more interviews they did, the better it was. And the behavior that we had actually inadvertently encouraged was busyness rather than effectiveness. Mm. And actually, when we went into COVID, and we were very lucky in the UK because the UK government allowed us to put people effectively sort of on gardening leave and not gardening leave, but keep them employed, and the government paid their salaries, and it was sort of kept us low cost, which was really, really good. But it was interesting. We basically were suddenly completely hands on with all our searches, and one of the things that we notice was actually, you know, we hadn't been working as efficiently as we could be, because we were over interviewing for each job, and actually by taking a little bit more time, waiting for a few more CVs to come in, selecting interview, you know, screening calls, and actually rather than spending an hour and a half with somebody saying, I'm not sure about this person, I'm going to give them 20 minutes on a screening call. And then actually saying, okay, yes, this person is worth fully interviewing, or no, it's not. Then I've only spent 20 minutes. What was happening was our delivery team was interviewing the whole, you know, everybody full interviews. And it was very, very time consuming in a service industry. Time was our limited resource. So actually, but it was really interesting. And maybe this is another thing is don't forget to go back to the shop floor and actually do the job. Because as an entrepreneur, when you actually get back and do the job, there are things that you notice. You say, actually, why are we doing it like this? This is like, you know, crazy. Or listen to new people coming in, seek feedback, have a look at what we're doing. You know, are we doing this best way? And we actually we retweaked our model at that point and changed it. And there's all sorts of things that we brought in that actually constantly looking at, you know, how do we make sure that we are accessing and interviewing the best available candidates, and that we're not missing good quality candidates, and that we're investing the time with the really good quality candidates and less time with the less good quality candidates because we're screening them out a bit better. So, you know, that whole ability to, you know, get down to the shop floor and really understand the job roles. And that happened when we actually, you know, it was sort of almost forced upon us, but it was actually one of the best things that actually happened, because we went, aha, You know, change the business model, and you know, and it's been far more effective. So
it's fantastic. Yeah, those who are listening have learned a lot about how to structure their business, how to find the right hire, and what they need to do in order to keep that structure as they're scaling. So I want to thank you so much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure.
Providing us with a bunch of wisdom that you've attained throughout the year. So thank you for joining us. And again, for those listening, executives in Africa, amazing leadership hiring team, and they can definitely find you the best people for your job. So thank you so much, Sarah, for joining.
Pleasure, Chris. And to anyone that's listening, please do feel free to reach out. I'm always happy to talk. And I love hearing about high growth companies, and genuinely are passionate about helping you find the right leaders to be successful in your business. So we're actually aligned in where we want to be going. So please do reach out directly to me on LinkedIn or via Chris. I'd love to hear about you and what you're doing. So, and thank you, Chris, for giving me this opportunity to talk.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Before you take your brain on an amazing journey applying what you just learned, here is what the lawyers are forcing me to tell you. And you know, you have to listen to the lawyers. So here goes. This podcast is presented to you solely for educational and informational entertainment purposes only. I'm a serial entrepreneur, as you know it, and I have a ton of personal experience in the school of entrepreneurship and hard knocks. But I am not a licensed teacher, therapist, and this podcast is not intended as a substitute for you to get more information and absorb more from other people. In fact, I encourage you to always learn more and seek out various viewpoints and opinions from people you trust and people who want you to succeed. Remember, it all ends well with faith. Stay blessed and humble to learn, and I'll catch you on the next episode. Take care.